Good morning. I am very excited about the lesson this morning. We're actually starting a series of lessons that I've been looking forward to. I think one of my favorite ministries that we have here at Maryville is the Soul Train Children's Education Ministry. I love the classes that our kids go to, how well structured it is, how intentional and purposeful every detail of it is. And I'm very thankful for all of those who work hard to make sure that it runs smoothly. I'm thankful to Jessica, Hazel, and I'm thankful to Michaela, and I'm thankful to every one of the parents and teachers and volunteers who helps teach the classes, who helps bring the kids from one place to another, all the conductors. And I'm thankful for every one of the parents who prioritizes bringing your children to that. The classes are better when there's more kids in them, and the relationships that the kids build are better. It is a wonderful thing for me as a parent when I'm talking to my kids about the Bible and they tell me something that I've never even taught them yet. I haven't taught, and I realize, hey, they're learning stuff. Like, the other people at church are teaching them things. That's a really cool thing, and I love seeing that, and it happens a lot. I think the thought and the wide range of biblical coverage that they experience in Soul Train is really wonderful. I've seen a lot of children's education programs, and not many of them are run this well. And so that's something I think is wonderful, and I'm very thankful for it. And what we're going to do in our sermon series is I'm going to let some of the kids from the Soul Train from Soul Train have a chance to ask some questions about the Bible that they've been wondering or they've been interested in. Because here's what we're calling it. Soul Train Wants to Know. And so what we've done, and we started this earlier in the year, is we've gotten some recordings of some of the kids from Soul Train asking Bible questions. And we opened up the doors. You can ask any question you want to ask. And this is something that maybe you've been thinking about, or something you'd like to know more about the Bible, or what we do at church, or why we do certain things. And there's something that I've learned about when kids ask questions. Usually the things that they're interested in, so are we. A lot of times the things that the kids want to know, the rest of us want to know also. Sometimes we might be afraid to ask, or sometimes we might think, you know, that's something I should have learned as a kid and I never did, and so now I'm an adult and I don't want to ask that question because that's... And a lot of times we can just kind of go through. I think usually the kids, the questions that kids have, like, everyone wants to talk about those things, and everyone's kind of curious about those things. And a lot of times they ask some tough questions, and they ask difficult questions. They have picked up on some of the difficult things that pop up either in the Bible or in what we do. And sometimes it's difficult on parents, you know, when you're asked questions and you think, oh, well, I don't know how to really answer that yet. So we're going to try, and we're gonna open up the door to some of the questions that our kids have. And so this morning I have four different questions from two of our different kids in Soul Train. And I have we'll be doing this over the next several weeks. And something else I want to ask is, if you do have kids in Soul Train, either we don't have a video of them yet, if you want to take one and send it to me with them asking a Bible question, please do that. Or send it to Jessica. I know she's keeping track of some of them also. But if you could do that, and then your child would be able to be a part of this as well. But what I'd like to do is start off with the first question, and then we'll discuss what the answer is.
My name is Amelia, and I was wondering if Jesus' birthday is actually on Christmas.
Okay, so that first question, it was from Amelia, and she asked, is Jesus' birthday actually on Christmas? And I love that question. I don't know about you, but the first morning I walk outside and it feels cool, I immediately start thinking, all right, Christmas is around the corner. We're getting to that time of year. And I'm tired of all those Grinches who don't want you thinking about Christmas until after Thanksgiving. I don't know if that's, I know that's a controversial take, but I think you can think about Christmas all year long for all I care. But she asked the question, is Jesus' birthday actually on Christmas? And one of the things that I wanted to be careful with doing with this, I did actually use the word answer a moment ago. I like question and response better than question and answer, because there are probably going to be times, I don't know if I have a really good and obvious answer to the question, but I can have a response to it that might generate some more thought or study or something like that. But I'm going to try to answer them in a way that would be helpful for a kid and try to make it simple, but then also maybe go into a few things that you might have some more interest in. So my answer to this question, or my response to this question, is probably not. So we celebrate Christmas on December 25th, and we often do that. The tradition is to do that in honor of the birth of Jesus. And I think that's a healthy and good thing to do. I think it is good to have reminders of important events of God throughout history. And I think the birth of Jesus, God in flesh being born into our world, is a wonderful thing to remember and to celebrate. And so I think that's an excellent thing to do. But if we're talking about historically, we need to be careful to decipher, I think this is always important, between what is actually historically reliable and what is truth and what is a tradition that has developed. And this is one of those areas where I do think tradition is more why we celebrate it on December 25th than historical truth. If you're trying to read the Bible to figure out what day of the year Jesus was born, Matthew and Luke are probably going to be your best bets. That's going to be the two books that give the infancy accounts of the life of Jesus. They tell the story of Jesus being born. And they don't give us any exact dates, and they don't give us very many clues for when exactly it would have been. We can narrow it down to a range of years based on some of the information from like the Gospel of Luke about who's ruling at the time, and you can do some math figuring out, you know, Jesus was 30 years old in the 15th year of time, and you can subtract backwards and try to figure out the rough time. And most scholars would put it around like 4 to 6 BC is when Jesus was born. Now you might think, I thought it was zero, Well, that math was done later, and it does seem like there was a few areas where when they first did it, they might not have gotten everything exact, and with some more discoveries about when these emperors were ruling, it's pushed back a little bit. But we do go from B.C. to A.D. Because of the birth of Jesus and the transformation that took place there, but we might be a few years off. But anyway, there's not many clues about the actual date of it. Some people have tried to find things based on the appearance of a star and when that would have happened in the year, or possibly based on shepherds, like when they would have been outside. But shepherds would sometimes, I mean, every month you could find shepherds probably outside with sheep on various occasions. And so I don't think you're going to get a ton of help there. I'm just going to say we don't really know exactly when Jesus' birth was on or what date it was. So that brings us to the question of why did we decide December 25th then? And this is something that there is a lot of wild speculation about. I see it every year as Christmas starts coming. And one of the things that people like to say is that, it happened because Christians noticed pagan celebrations going on and they wanted to kind of like hijack those things. And if people were already celebrating, we can turn those into Christian something. And so basically there are some ideas that it kind of has pagan origins. And based on my understanding of the history and the evidence, that is probably not the case. I think there were probably Christian reasons that they did this. If you look at the actual evidence for December 25th being the birth date of Jesus, and you're looking at whether or not that is rooted in the birth dates of other ancient Greco-Roman gods or Greek gods or Egyptian gods. Like, there are people who say, like, well, Osiris was born or Mithras was born on December 25th. All of that stuff is just made up. Like, we don't have that in the ancient sources. People say that a lot. That's in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, but there's no actual historical evidence that those things are accurate. We don't have dates for when they were born. So that's just made up stuff. And if you do eventually see, like, there were Roman celebrations that took place a lot. And you can find historically, a Roman celebration that happened on a December 25th. But there's not actually any direct connection that we can find between those. There was a much bigger Roman celebration that in the honor of Saturn that was a couple of days before that. And if you were to take a calendar and throw a dart at it, you're probably going to hit some Roman celebration somewhere. They happen a lot. And so saying, well, we can find evidence of one, you know, Roman celebration on December 25th means that Jesus's birthday was chosen in honor of that. I think there's just not a lot there. I think people try to find something there. And it's actually, interestingly enough, been Puritans and sometimes Protestants who have leveled those accusations. And one of the reasons why is because of like an anti-Catholic bias trying to discredit some of Catholicism rather than actually being based on evidence. You don't see any of that stuff being said by the early church in some of the writings that we have about this. So why is December 25th chosen? Again, I think the evidence for mythology and paganism is lacking, but there still is a question, well, why did it end up getting chosen as December 25th? And I think there's a couple of things that led to that. One thing is we don't actually see early Christians celebrating Christmas for the first couple hundred years. We're talking probably in the 300s when that first starts being taken more seriously. And one of the reasons why is that early Christians and Jews didn't usually celebrate birthdays. That's something that we take, for granted as a normal part of society that we celebrate birthdays. But Jews actually did usually see birthdays as something that was more of a Gentile thing to do. And if you look in the Bible, you don't see like in the Law of Moses any admonition to celebrate birthdays or things like that. They had certain feast days that they would celebrate annually, and they had things like that. But you don't see birthdays as a major part of that. You see Pharaoh in Genesis celebrate a birthday, and you see Herod in Matthew celebrate a birthday, but you don't often see it among normal practicing Jews and then in early Christians. So why would they start celebrating the birthday of Jesus? Like I said, I don't think they did for the first couple hundred years, but one of the things that led to it, I believe, is a response to an early Christian or an early view of Jesus called Docetism, which maintained the idea that Jesus was born, that Jesus was did not have a flesh and blood body. He was actually just like a spirit being who appeared to be there, but he wasn't actually physically there. And one of the things that, if you're going to maintain Docetism, you have a problem with Jesus not having a flesh and blood body, yet still being actually physically born. And so I think in response, you had some people who believed, Jesus, I would say now it's more common for people to say, yeah, Jesus was real, but he was just a man, right? Just a human being, not really God. That's what unbelievers would say about Jesus. Well, in the early church, you had more people who would say Jesus was truly God, but not really a man. And the orthodox position that Christianity came down on is, no, he's actually a man and God. And that's what I think the Bible teaches also. He is fully human and truly human, but he's also truly God. So that means he is God, but he still had a body, and he still was born. And so if you want evidence that Jesus had a body, a birth is a pretty good thing to celebrate and to talk about. He actually was born. And so I think there was a reason that the early church wanted to start talking about the birth of Jesus, and that deals with the fact that he actually did have a real, true flesh and blood body. He was truly human. Now, why would they choose December 25th for that? Well, it's hard to find anything overly significant about December 25th in early Christianity that would have led to that. But there was, from even earlier than this, another date in Christianity that was pretty significant, and I think this is probably the one that led to December 25th. March 25th was a very important date in early Christianity, and it still is. We don't talk a lot about it in our circles, probably, but that is called the Annunciation. And that is an even earlier date that we have. We have this date being mentioned even all the way back to the second century, and this is the date that early Christians believed. Not only was this the date that Jesus was crucified on, but they also believed that this was the date that the angel Gabriel appeared to Mary and announced that she was going to have a child, that she was pregnant. And so the conception of Jesus, it has from an early date been attributed to March 25th. Now again, we can say that might not be historically accurate either, but that is the earlier tradition. And what happens when you calculate 9 months after March 25th? You get to December 25th. And so if there was already an early Christian tradition that he was conceived miraculously on March 25th, To me, the simplest explanation isn't to try to find something where Christians are looking to the Greco-Roman world and finding some obscure holiday and saying that that's the main. I think actually what probably happened was they just did the math from what they already believed about his conception, and they said that his birth was 9 months after that, and so that takes you from March 25th to December 25th. And so to me, that's the simplest explanation of it. And historically, that makes the most sense, at least in my view of why we celebrated on December 25th. So Christmas originated and endured for Christian reasons rather than pagan reasons. And it's an important memorial and celebration. So that would be my quick answer to that question. Question number two.
My name is Levi, and I was wondering if you know was this my father, if he knows it was about David and Goliath. How did David know that God would be with him and when he defeated Goliath? If God thank you for my family, my Christ, and myself, please help the safe food better and all the bad to become God. But Levi, Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Amen. Okay, so thank you for that question, Levi. Basically, the question is, how did David know that God would be with him when he fought Goliath? Because if you read 1 Samuel 17, that's where this passage is going to come from, David's quite confident, saying that the Lord will deliver me from your hand. He'll deliver this Philistine into my hands, and he attributes it to what the Lord will do throughout. Yet, if you're reading it, I don't see a place where God specifically tells David that I will give you the victory. I don't see a place where, like, David is, assured beforehand. So how does David go into this with such confidence? And I think there might be a couple of things, because David does talk a little bit. He has to convince the king to let him go fight. Because if you remember, Goliath is a mighty warrior, right? He is a Philistine. He's a giant. He's head and shoulders taller than everyone else. He's either like 9'6" or like 6'6", depending on which ancient manuscript you read. But a really tall dude, especially when you consider that most Israelites at that time would have been like 5'2" or 5'3". You know, most people were shorter back then. And so when you're comparing them to Goliath, it's a massive difference. And here you have a king who has to put the fate of his nation into the hands of someone to go out and fight this giant out there. And so who's he going to choose? Well, I imagine he would prefer to choose one of his best warriors. But instead, he gets this young shepherd who's not really a skilled warrior and doesn't have a lot of experience on the battlefield. And so David has to convince him. And one of the things that David uses, and I think it's good that Saul listened, David doesn't seem to ground this in his experience as a warrior. He doesn't ground this in logic per se. He grounds it in the experience that he's had with God and what God has done for Israel before and what he believes God will do. So to Saul, it becomes not a question of, is David a great warrior, but can I put my trust in God? And so David absolutely is confident that God will be with him, but that's also how he is able to reason with Saul to let him do it. So David gives several lines of reasoning. He does, in these verses right here, directly say that God will give him this victory. He says that God will deliver Goliath, and he says that he will do so as he has delivered me in the past. One of the things that David mentions is God's history of delivering him from a bear and from a lion. He says, like, there have been times where I should have lost battles before, but God was with me and I was successful. And I believe that same thing is going to happen again. God will be with me again as I confront not a bear or a lion, but here this giant. I think also the fact that Goliath had been directly challenging God and Israel filled David with confidence that God would be with him in this. If it were perhaps something like some battle that had nothing to do with defending the honor of Israel or God or something, then maybe who knows. But David, I do think he's interpreting the battle in light of Goliath's challenge against God, and I think he is quite convinced that God will be with him because of that. But then also, and I would just say, it's a knowledge that's based on trust. I don't think that it's a knowledge that he could have apart from faith. I don't think it is a knowledge that he had based on absolute certainty of what was going to happen. I think it's a knowledge he had based on, you know, he knows the story of Israel, that against their enemies, God has delivered them in some pretty incredible ways before. You can look at that throughout the story of Joshua. You can look throughout the history of Israel and see God's deliverance. He can look in his own life and see God's deliverance from the bear and the lion, is what he mentions. He can look at the challenge of Goliath in challenging God and challenging Israel. And I think in all of those ways, he put his trust in God. And ultimately, so did Saul to allow him to do it. Now, one of the things that is interesting about this is that David does go to confront Goliath, but he does it in an unexpected manner. I mean, Goliath is expecting someone to come out there with a spear and a sword. And David goes out there, and he has a stick. And that's what Goliath notices. He says, "You're coming out, you think I'm a dog? You're just going to come out and fight me off with a stick like a shepherd?" And this shepherd who had his shepherding stick also had a shepherding bag. And what Goliath might not have known is that in that bag there were five smooth stones. And what would ordinarily be a weapon that you would use at a distance, like a sling, David brought that to a fight that was a short distance fight, a close encounter. And in those ways, I think what you're seeing is it wasn't actually might that gave David the victory. It was God. And I think it was also that he outsmarted Goliath. He did the unexpected thing, and God worked in that way to bring about this victory. And so God was able to give him the victory even without sword and javelin and spear. And so I think you see a couple of things where what you expect is reversed in this passage. Not only you expect the great warrior to beat the small warrior, but you would expect this weapon to be used rather than this weapon. But David kind of reverses some of those things. And in so doing, he ends up becoming victorious in some surprising ways. And that's actually one of the major themes throughout the books of 1 Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, is where you see like the tall person, whether it's Goliath or whether it's Saul, who people would assume are great because of that, they end up falling. And it's actually usually the smaller person or the person who's the least in the family who ends up being elevated. And so it's playing into those. But I do think that David's faith might be something similar to like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If you remember before the fiery furnace, I think they believed that God would save them, but they also recognized they didn't have to. They also recognize this is the right thing to do, whether God saves me or not. So they're being threatened with thrown into a fiery furnace, and they say, our God will deliver us, but even if he doesn't, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to bow down to that idol that you've made. And I think David, whether he's going to win or not, knows that he has to do something. And so he's confident God will give him the victory, but regardless of the outcome, standing up was the right thing to do. And so I think that's a lot of behind what David does in his actions. Question number three.
My name is Amelia, and my question is, why do the grown-ups take the little cups?
Amelia wants to know why the grown-ups take the little cups. I think we're talking about the Lord's Supper here, and I think that that's an awesome question, because that's a strange ritual that we do. That's something that you don't see other places, and you wonder, why is it that the grown-ups are doing that? And so when it comes to that, I think there's a couple of things. Again, you're going to have a Bible answer. You see that this is something you can read it in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and you can read it in 1 Corinthians, because this is something that Jesus started, and this is part of a meal. There is a Passover meal, and Jesus took a small part of it, which was the cup and the bread, and he gave that to his disciples, and he told them he wants them to continue doing that. That's something he wants to be a regular part of their spiritual lives until he comes to eat it with them again. So he eats it with them at the beginning, and he promises to eat it with them again. And in the midst, it's something he wants them to continually doing in his honor. And the early church, as they would gather on the first day, they would continue doing this. And so that's something that we continue in as well. So what does it mean? Well, it means a lot of things. But Jesus does in that meal assign particular meaning to the bread and to the wine that is different than the meaning it had at the Passover meal. The meaning that Jesus gives to it is the bread is his body. And he says that the cup is his blood. in his body, that's going to remind us of things like Christmas, things like the incarnation. Remind us that he actually did have a true flesh and blood body. And the blood will remind us of the covenant that we have with him, the cross and the blood that was shed, the forgiveness of sins. I think all of these things are combined in this so that as we do this, we're remembering God's love for us in becoming human and giving his life for us and shedding his blood and the power of that blood that binds us into an eternal agreement with God and a relationship with him and forgives us every step along the way. And so as we talk about the Lord's Supper, it has profound meaning, but also something is actually happening when we take the Lord's Supper. And I think it's important to know that also. So what happens when we get together and when we do this? I think if you read through the Bible, you see a good number of things mentioned. But one thing is we do remember. We remember the past. We remember what Jesus did for us. We remember the incarnation. And we remember his death on the cross. We remember him establishing this meal and dining with his disciples. But we also proclaim. 1 Corinthians says, we proclaim his death until he comes again. This is a proclamation that we are a people who exist because not Jesus killed his enemies, but because he died for his enemies, and he died for us. This is a proclamation of the meaning of the death of Jesus. We unite in this. We unite with one another to share a common meal with each other, to share a meal where we're all participating in, all eating the same thing for the same reason. And that is something that whether you're Jew or Gentile or black or white or young or old, you come together and you do it. And I think that sort of unity is profound, and it's enduring, and it's something the world is in need of. We also participate or fellowship in it. And the fellowship is described not only as what we have with one another, but this is also a mystical fellowship or participation with Jesus in this moment. Even though we might recognize his absence in some sense, we also recognize his presence with us through the meal. And it's something that we are participating and fellowshipping with him while we do it. And I would also say that we hope. This is a meal of hope where we are looking towards the age to come, and we're looking towards eating this meal again with Jesus in glory. And so it's a profound moment where we come together, we remember what Jesus did, we proclaim the truth of it now, and we look for the present or for the future where we will dine with him again. And then the last question.
My name is Levi, and I've been wondering why we have to die to go to heaven.
So that's actually a really good question, too. The question is, why do we have to die to go to heaven? Why couldn't there be another way to go to heaven? Or why is it that that we don't just start off in heaven? Or like, why? I think that's a really good question. And I think that there's a lot that could be said about it. I'll say it quickly. But why do we have to die to go to heaven? Well, one thing I think we need to define kind of what we mean by heaven, if we're going to talk about this. The way the Bible usually speaks about where we spend eternity, it actually doesn't usually use the word heaven for that. It'll use the words like in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Or it'll say like in the age to come. Or sometimes it'll use the language of new heavens and new earth. Or it'll use the language of in the regeneration, which is like the rebirth. Or in the renewal of all things. That's an expression that's used. But if you actually do a word study on heaven, heaven is often pictured as the dwelling place of God. Heaven is where God currently is. Heaven is where Jesus came from and ascended to, and heaven is where our kingdom originates from. But it's not actually usually used for the future eternal home of Christians. But that is often how we use the term. And so if that's what we mean by this, if we mean by heaven just where we'll live for eternity, then I would say, technically, we don't have to die for that. You can read through and you can see maybe a few examples of people who seem to have gone to heaven without death, maybe Enoch or maybe Elijah. But then also there's passages in the New Testament, like 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that talks about at the return of Jesus, there will be a transformation that takes place, and those who have died, they will be resurrected and they will be with Jesus. But those who are alive, They get transformed immediately without death into an eternal glorified state, ready for the age to come. And so death isn't actually an essential part of going to heaven. Death is the normal way that most people go, but it's not essential to it happening. But why is that the normal way? If it is the normal order of events for most people, why? One thing I would say is I do think heaven is going to be better. If heaven is the greatest place you can imagine, right, then in order for it to be great, I think one of the things that is important is to have something to compare it to. It's hard to have greatness without having experienced something that makes you yearn for greatness. So if satisfaction is part of greatness, then yearning for satisfaction, yearning and hoping for something greater, I think would be an important part of that. So one thing that makes heaven better is that you eventually arrive there. And I think that's just true to what it means to be human, is things are better when you, I'm not going to say earn it because you don't earn it, but things are better when you long for it before receiving it. And I think that that is something that's an important part of heaven being as good as it can be. It should be something we long for before receiving. But I would also say that our experience on earth not only prepares us for heaven through yearning and longing, but also it helps make us people, I think, who are more fit for heaven. Love of enemies, I think, is a wonderful thing that is central to the mission of Jesus. And yet, I don't know how many enemies we're going to have in heaven. I think learning love of enemies is something that will make heaven a more beautiful and profound experience. I think helping those in need is something that makes us better people and it transforms us. But I don't know if there's going to be many people in need in heaven. Or having compassion on those who are suffering. Or generosity towards those in need. Or having courage in the face of danger. Like, these are all important character building things that I think it's much easier to envision how we experience and grow from those through life on earth rather than simply life in heaven. So I think heaven is better if we long for it first. I think we are better if we experience life before heaven. But then also, I think it's an important and profound demonstration. The fact that heaven is after death, that no matter what Satan or the powers of darkness have thrown at us, whether it's sin or death itself, it cannot conquer and defeat God's plans. I think it's a profound statement of victory over death, that death tries to attack us first, and yet we ultimately receive victory over it. Through the death and resurrection of Jesus, we recognize that no power of heaven and earth, no power of darkness, like no power of the demonic forces or anything like that, can keep us from reaching God's goal for us or can thwart God's plans. Resurrection after death is the ultimate victory. And so I think in order to demonstrate the victory of God and for us to share in that victory, it's important for it to come after death. And so, again, way more can be said about every one of those four questions. We will be doing this for the next couple of weeks, and I think we'll get into some pretty interesting stuff. But here's the challenge as we draw this lesson to a close. We've covered a range of topics, and it's hard to summarize them all down into one challenge. But here's what I chose. Never stop searching, learning, and growing. I love that these kids have these questions, but the reality is I think we all have some questions, and I think all of us could benefit from seeking and growing and questioning. I think generous questioning, like honest, sincere questions, is one of the most important aspects of discipleship and of growth. And so I want to encourage everyone to think about the Bible. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions of the Bible or to other Christians. Let's be a healthy environment that facilitates honest questions, healthy responses, faithful united Bible study, and I think we would grow from that rather than it would harm us. And if there's anyone here this morning who would like to become a Christian and to name Christ as the Lord of your life, please let that be known. You can talk to one of our elders in the back, or you can come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.